This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
The BFM Breakfast Grill, connecting you to the top people and ideas. Presented by U Mobile.
Good morning, I'm Noelle Lim. The Malaysian authorities have been tracking down individuals who attended the mass gathering at the mosque in Sri Petaling, which resulted in a spike in COVID-19 cases. Among these individuals are an estimated 2,000 Rohingyas. Today we explore the plight of refugees and migrant workers and whether they are adequately protected and cared for in Malaysia. On the panel is Lily Ann Phan, co-founder and international director of Getanyo Foundation and chairperson of the Rohingya Working Group at the Asia Pacific Refugee Rights Network. The other member of the panel is Nilim Barua. He is the Regional Migration Specialist at the International Labour Organization for Asia and the Pacific. Thank you for making time for this call on Zoom. The government is working through NGOs to reach out to the refugee community to test for COVID-19 after the outbreak in the Sri Petaling Mosque. What is the status?
I think that at first we need to try to move away from this type of language that separates the larger population of people who, you know, could be infected, like Malaysians and you know, others who are here legally in the country, and other groups such as refugees and migrants. I think that, you know, generally it's not that helpful, because this really is a pandemic that's affecting everybody. Having said that, of course, there are specific challenges that are faced both by refugees and the migrant population, especially undocumented migrants, and also agencies and organizations, and including the government, who try to assist them. This figure that emerged of 2,000 Rohingya refugees, it was never verified. It was actually a figure that popped out, we think, because of a misunderstanding, that in fact it was a different population, or it was another group that had such figures, and the Rohingya were getting blamed for it because this number just went viral. What's more important is that everybody who was in attendance was having access to, in fact, reach the government and be able to have themselves screened and tested. There are a lot of people actually from the Rohingya community, from the Burmese Muslim migrant community, from many other refugee and migrant communities who, in fact, have just come forward voluntarily. One of the really good things that happened, I think, quite early on was that UNHCR and NGOs started to really work on translations of materials, the kind of global guidance, the good practices of hygiene. There were UNHCR hotlines, which are still functioning in various languages, in Rohingya, in Burmese, in Arabic, in Dari, for the Afghans, in various languages. Challenge for them was the fact that there was no real statement at that time, when these figures were going around, that refugees or migrants or whoever, that anybody basically, regardless of immigration status, would be treated equally and would be able to access screening and treatment without the fear of arrest. So I think the government, the Ministry of Health in particular, has actually been very good. They did issue quite early on, back in January, a circular which stated that all foreigners would actually receive screening and treatment for free if they had symptoms, if they were showing symptoms or they were a suspected case. But it wasn't really well known. And I think beyond that, the bigger fear that was facing refugees and migrants was in fact the fear of arrest. And that was something that really needed to be tackled. It was only after the Minister of Defense really came out publicly and strongly and clearly said, this is not about immigration status. This is really about getting anybody who might be at risk tested. And it's for your safety, it's for everybody's safety. And they promised that nobody would get arrested. That's when we started seeing much more confidence from these populations and these communities. People felt much safer. People felt confident that they wouldn't be penalized.
Well, zooming out, what's the situation on the ground for migrant workers? Are employers doing enough to ensure they are receiving proper protection and care?
The UN Convention on the Protection of Migrant Workers and Members of the Families says that undocumented migrant workers should have access to emergency healthcare. So it's very important, and that there are no sanctions. The other aspect is the economic dimensions. And as you know, that migrant workers, whether they are documented or undocumented, are not covered in unemployment insurance. Also, we have seen that when some measures have been taken, such as regarding employee retention, the migrant workers are not covered in this. So all the relief measures, stimulus packages should cover documented migrant workers. Ideally, they should cover the undocumented migrant workers as well, but I understand that may be something difficult for Malaysian policymakers. But documented migrant workers who have been paying taxes, who are in the system, should have equal treatment in relief measures and social protection. About 20% of the workforce in Malaysia is comprised of migrant workers. And migrant workers are very important in certain sectors of the economy, like construction, manufacturing, agriculture, plantations. They're working in households as domestic workers.
So what would be the alternative protection for them?
According to the most recent estimates from the World Bank, which did a research on the number of irregular migrant workers in Malaysia, they estimated between 1.23 million and 1.46 million persons. So that's a large number of persons. It's a win-win to reduce the number of undocumented migrant workers. And to do that, to reduce this large number, the only way is to do a regularization. The certain criteria should be there. You know, the measures should have been taken that regularized migrant workers. If migrant workers have a job, they are working in a sector where there are labor shortages, if they don't have a criminal record and they have been in the country, they should have an opportunity to regularize their employment status and become documented.
So what's stalling this process?
Unlike, say, in Thailand, where they had a large number of undocumented migrant workers, and that has been significantly reduced because of the regularization process. In Malaysia, that did not happen because the reliance on agents rather than doing it directly by one-stop centers. There was also, in some of the regularization, there were fines for overstay, which is, of course, a disincentive.
Why is it that we use the agency model? It would delay the process of regularizing workers.
There has been reports of corruption, bribes. The process has been cumbersome, so it has not worked well.
And why is it so difficult to crack down on this chain of corruption?
To begin with, you have to look at the whole recruitment process. There have been more workers that have been recruited or coming in than they are actual jobs. The recruitment process has been sometimes looked at as a revenue generating exercise rather than matching vacancies to job seekers. So that whole process can be improved and there can be more options given to employers and job seekers for recruitment.
This seems like it requires a political will. So how confident are you that this current government can carry this out, do this proper regularization and do the necessary deportation if it has to come down to that?
So it is a new government now. Let us see. The previous government had done a review of the migration policy and practices, and there was an independent commission which produced a report. The UN and the ILO have made recommendations and including on this area of undocumented migrant workers.
our airport borders are closed, but I am inclined to think they are still porous on land and sea in East Malaysia. And the COVID-19 situation is extremely serious in Indonesia and also the Philippines. How concerned should Malaysia be about the inflow of people who may be coming in through those borders? And what sort of health support, health check support is available? If you could, you know, share your experience, what might be happening on the ground?
The best way to deal with that is to see that the legal channels are working well. We, Dialo, along with the IOM, did a survey in 2018 of the migration processes and flows to Thailand, to Malaysia, and in the surrounding countries. And we did find that of the migrant workers, the returnees who were surveyed, most of them used informal channels. They crossed the border without documentation. You know, the paperwork is time-consuming. For example, in Malaysia, I believe the medical test has to be taken twice, both in the country of origin and in Malaysia. So that is clearly a waste of resources and time. The costs are higher, the fees that are paid to the recruiter. So all these are a disincentive for the legal channels.
On The Breakfast Grill this morning, I'm speaking with Lilian Phan, co-founder of the Getanyo Foundation and chairperson of the Rohingya Working Group at the Asia-Pacific Refugee Rights Network. And also on the panel is Neelim Barua, Regional Migration Specialist at the International Labour Organization for Asia and the Pacific. Stay tuned to learn more about the plight of refugees and migrant workers.
You are listening to the BFM Breakfast Grill, brought to you by U Mobile.
Welcome back. Today I'm speaking with Lilian Phan of Getanyo Foundation and Neelim Barua of the International Labour Organization. Now with the movement's control order, many refugees would have probably lost their jobs or source of donation. How dire is their situation?
Yeah, when it comes to refugees, I mean, the situation is extremely dire. I think we need to remember there are some distinctive things about the refugee communities as well, which I think make them extremely vulnerable. One is that actually most of them are really struggling to work anyway. You know, they're not here primarily to find work. They didn't leave their countries mainly, you know, the first motivation to leave wasn't economic security. It was really to flee a situation of war or persecution. That's what makes somebody a refugee. And it's the push factor more than the pull factor for refugees that really makes them leave. And many refugees who are in Malaysia, you know, those who just in order to survive, they do need, many of them do need to work illegally. But there are many, many refugees here who are not working and are really depending on support from organizations. I think what we're really concerned about is the communities where the government doesn't have a database. So these would be the refugees, undocumented migrants, and also stateless persons. In Malaysia who don't have ICs, you know, who are stateless for one reason or another, including the large number of stateless persons in Sabah. We have to remember that, I mean, for refugees, this is a country which never has never had a refugee policy. We don't have a national asylum system. In livelihoods, we've never gotten around to actually developing a proper framework for refugees' you know, legal right to work in this country. We've had pilot projects of a really, you know, tiny number of refugees that have been going on for a couple of years, but it's and lots of discussion in the last the previous government under the Pakatan government about how to move forward on the refugee work rights proposals, studies being done, but as of yet nothing official. So I think, you know, this is still an area which really does need to be taken seriously, and I do hope if anything you know, positive comes out of this experience for these communities, I do hope that it's that the government actually starts to take documentation extremely seriously, because I think this crisis, more than anything, it really shows us the importance of knowing who's in the country and knowing how to reach people, knowing where people are, having the ability, you know, for the government to be able to reach out to anybody in this country, regardless of immigration status. And that's really important to look at documentation.
But why is it in the past that we don't have the data, we don't have a national asylum system, no domestic refugee laws, and giving some status to refugees, at least, you know, for them to work? Why the inertia?
Well, you know, the big argument has always been the pull factor, right? That basically, you know, if we regularize refugees or we give some legal status to refugees, we're going to open the floodgates. And again, I think that's actually, you know, it's not really an argument that really stands up. Biggest push for refugees is the biggest reason they come is a push factor. You know, if we look at who are the refugees in this country, you know, in fact, the largest number of people are the people who are coming here, not because it's easy to come here. You know, they're coming here because they're really fleeing for their lives. It's the Rohingya. That's the biggest population here. And it's expensive, you know, for a community that is suffering in Rakhine State in Myanmar and in the camps in Bangladesh, you know, for many years, who are basically have no livelihoods even there, have no assets, have no savings. They are risking their lives and everything they have, going into huge debts to get out of those situations. So you have, you know, communities like Syrians, Afghans, and many others from the Middle East and Arab world and the Near East, who in fact don't need visas to come to Malaysia. And you would imagine that because of that, the numbers would be enormous, but they're actually not enormous.
How do we move forward in giving more protection to refugees?
You have to give it to the government, both the last one as well as hopefully this one, but also, you know, the technical level also, that hasn't changed. Many of them have been taking much more effort and, you know, really trying to understand these issues in a much more substantive way. Would be very nice to be able to have, you know, the UN Convention on Refugees signed at some point. But I think what you actually need is to have a roadmap towards that. And, you know, how do you put in place the type of systems and the types of laws and provisions and institutional arrangements that would allow you to get to that point where, you know, that could be an ideal, and that eventually you've got a system where signing a convention is actually the last step rather than the first step. So I think that's the type of thing that we need to start adopting. Very first priority is documentation. If you don't give legal documentation to these populations, to refugees, you know, you really can't talk in a very meaningful way about any of those other things. And it would also, of course, address the issue of our overcrowded immigration centres. You know, our immigration detention centres right now are filled with all types of people, you know, including asylum seekers and refugees. Health conditions in those centres are really, really lacking. They're really worrying, as it is, you know, even in normal times. And I don't think even, you know, the immigration would contest that.
Neelim, I want to come back to you about migrant workers. The government can introduce policies to ensure they are treated more fairly. But in reality, I would imagine migrant workers do face a lot of discrimination.
I think a lot can be done towards generating a better image of migrant workers that contribute to the actual contribution. We have done public attitude surveys in Malaysia as well as in Singapore, Thailand, Korea, Japan. And many people have the perception that especially undocumented migrant workers are not entitled to any rights. But in fact, if you look at the ILO conventions, undocumented migrant workers have the same labor rights that arise out of past employment. So they have worked in a particular place, they are owed the wages and benefits that they have earned. At the same time, in international law, the government has the right to control its borders, to reduce, prevent undocumented migration. But that should be done in a way that respects the individual rights of each person. There should be no collective detention, no collective expulsion, each case has to be seen in its own right.
It's been lovely speaking to both of you. Thank you again for your time and stay well. Lilian Phan from Getanyo Foundation and Nilim Barua at the International Labour Organization for Asia and the Pacific. I'm Noel Lim on BFM 89.9.
The Breakfast Grill is brought to you by U-Mobile, encouraging you to stay home during this period of movement control.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.